Friday.
This is The Takeaway for Friday, September 29th, 2017.
Need to get back. I need to get back to my life. And there's no water. There's no electricity. I don't see anything coming anytime soon.
I don't think there's one inch in Puerto Rico that has not been touched by this hurricane.
It's just difficult to focus on anything but trying to find information.
You know, you're just drilled to your phone waiting for them to call you, because when I call, it just sounds disconnected or you know, that sounds terrible already in my head.
I've got people messaging me, probably 30 people a minute, saying my family needs help, my family needs water, my family needs to eat.
It's been a very difficult thing to be across the Atlantic feeling completely helpless because I can't help from here.
I've never imagined that there could be so little security in America.
Do not forget us and do not let us feel alone.
All that he was able to tell us was that, could you please send us food, water, and things like that that we can use, like flashlights, candles. And then the call got cut off. And that's as much connection as we've had.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. We're glad to have you with us on this Friday. And those are voices, many of them from our show this week, 9 days since Category 4 Hurricane Maria made landfall in Puerto Rico. There's been a lot of criticism leveled at the federal response to the disaster in Puerto Rico. Some of that criticism has come from within the government itself. Container ships full of relief goods still sit undelivered in port, while water and food are dangerously scarce. Democratic Congressman Darren Soto represents Florida's 9th Congressional District, east of Tampa in Central Florida, with a large Puerto Rican population. He's been outspoken in calling for a faster response to the crisis.
For about 7 days, we saw the Trump administration really get behind the eight ball. I believe they grossly underestimated the devastation, but finally we're getting things moving. Yesterday, we had General Kim of the Army appointed to spearhead the entire effort. We had the Jones Act wave, so foreign ships can also help out with aid. We brought several Navy vessels down there, including the USS Comfort, which is basically a floating hospital. But we need manpower, particularly because we have a lot of containers down there containing well-needed supplies, but they're stacked up in the port. And so finally we're getting the kind of personnel down there to get this out. But I know there's been an outpouring throughout the nation of people helping, and the supplies have just really bottlenecked down there.
Talk about the situation in the port a little bit and what you've been told in briefings. Thousands of containers piled up there and no way to distribute them.
So we were told at first by the military that the port was had damage and therefore they couldn't bring these major ships down there. Miraculously, several days later, they were able to do that. So a lot of us were real concerned about that being a delay without a distinction. But from there, we're bringing down thousands of additional personnel to help out with this effort of getting these supplies off of these containers and throughout the island. One of the big problems still is that the mountainous areas of the island are still inaccessible by many vehicles. So really right now it's about getting the whole breadth of resources from the Army to be able to move these things. We invade countries that are hostile to us quicker than we saw this humanitarian invasion that we so desperately needed in Puerto Rico.
And the condition in some of these towns in the more mountainous interior where food and water appears to be in short supply, what have you been told?
It's desperate. You know, almost the whole island doesn't have power. Cell phone service is out in 85% of the towers. We have people drinking water out of their pools and out of rivers, the rivers, some of which may be polluted. And supermarkets are out of food, and most of the gas stations are destroyed. So people who are trying to use generators are waiting online for hours. So it's a set of conditions that most Americans would find to be outrageous. But we are getting the manpower down there finally to do that after literally several of us, including New York's Serrano and Velasquez and Chicago's Gutierrez and I, screaming at our desk for days. But we're finally getting movement, and I hope to go down there this Sunday to see the damage firsthand.
Congressman Soto, you represent the district with the densest population of Puerto Rican American citizens in the United States, the Florida 9th Congressional District, just east of Tampa Bay there in Central Florida. What have your calls been like? What have your meetings in your district been like? What are people saying to you about their families, their friends back home on the island?
Well, people are scared. Like my family, which most of us are here in Florida now, but we still have friends back on the island. They can't reach people, and still to this day. So some people have had to find out through third parties whether their family was okay. And of course, there's been a difficulty of getting folks off the island, and we had to send out letters to point out potential price gouging. So they just want to be able to know how their loved ones are doing, and also to understand whether or not they could get them off the island. We expect, at least for the time being, as they're fixing the grid, which is destroyed, that tens of thousands of my fellow Puerto Ricans will probably come from the island to Florida, perhaps New York, Illinois, other areas where they have family, as they're rebuilding this grid and all these cell phone towers.
Congressman Darren Soto, I want to thank you for joining us. I hope you'll come back and give us your assessment after you visit on Sunday.
You bet, Todd. Thank you.
Congressman Darren Soto of the 9th Congressional District in Florida.
Is the frequency any is Whiskey 6 Lima Gulf?
W6 Lima Gulf, Lima Gulf, W5 Abbey.
November 6, Radio Sierra X-Ray. Over, over.
Okay, November 6, Radio Sierra X-Ray. We've got you loud and clear aboard the International Space Station. Welcome aboard.
You're listening there to communications over ham radios, and yes, even the International Space Station has one. Ham radios have been on the scene for decades in garages and hobby basements all over the world. Ham radios are reliable and can connect over thousands of miles. So when communications went dead in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria, amateur radio put out the call, and now more than 50 volunteer radio operators are on the ground in Puerto Rico. They're bringing vital communications to recovery operations that would otherwise be dark. Mike Corey is the Emergency Preparedness Manager with the National Association for Amateur Radio, who put the radio volunteers on the ground in Puerto Rico.
This group has been ARRL's force of 50. There were 50 volunteers that were put on the list. 20 are deployed. They will be deploying with Red Cross shelter teams across Puerto Rico and working with those teams as a full member of the shelter team, to provide communications between shelters and also getting information on shelter occupants back into the Red Cross safe and well system.
So this is all a function of the cell phone system being down, right? I mean, we heard reports earlier this week of officials in Puerto Rico getting messages literally by messenger, somebody running, driving to a town, running up the street with a piece of paper to hand to a mayor or a local governor.
Right. It's very much like that. The cellular networks are down, internet, and of course, with a lack of power, that contributes to the problem. Amateur radio operators in Puerto Rico that were also affected by the storm were able to set up some temporary message networks under emergency power. And of course, now as relief efforts are underway, more amateur radio operators are going in to help kind of beef up that network.
So what kind of training goes into this for your operators who volunteer like this? It's one thing to be in your garage or in your house and participate in amateur radio. Another thing to do it by the book and get all the protocols right. So what do they have to know?
The knowledge base going into something like this is pretty extensive. It is starting with being active in the amateur radio service from home. Just participating in it is a kind of a training in and of itself. Along with that, the amateur radio operators that are going have also done some cross-training with Red Cross. They've taken part in FEMA training, some independent study through FEMA's online program. They've made themselves familiar not with just how to be a good amateur radio operator, and in this case under very austere conditions, but also how to work within the environment of disaster response when you're going to be working with many different agencies and organizations that will be providing relief.
And is ham radio in this case just super reliable as a form of communication?
It is in many ways. Our ability to communicate can be done with or without infrastructure. We can use batteries, generators, solar power. So when normal means are compromised in some way, this independent communications network of amateur radio can really help get the message through when other means may not be available. And also just the diversity of the network. There's 750,000 licensees in the United States. So having this spread out network gives the possibility of getting the message to another station that may be able to relay to its final destination, or just simply get it into an email or onto, say, an online database if you're trying to get the information there. So it's a network of licensees that can be independent or work right alongside existing infrastructure.
So your volunteers are on the ground there in Puerto Rico. They'll be fanning out with the Red Cross, as you mentioned. I assume they're bringing their own equipment on this mission. How much gear do you need when you fly out on a mission like this?
Well, this one is a little bit different because we've never quite done one to this scale with so many outside volunteers coming in. So one of the things that we worked out with Red Cross is they would provide the logistics for getting volunteers trained, deployed, and set up. We would provide the communications equipment, we being the ARRL. So we sent with each one of the volunteers a Pelican case full of radio equipment, an HF radio for long-haul communications and VHF radios for short-distance communications, as well as all the tools and cables and wires and antennas that would be needed. So each volunteer went with one of these cases. The case weighs about 60 pounds and about the size of a suitcase. So they went and deployed with that. But even in an emergency or a disaster, maybe a bit more locally or on the mainland, they would typically deploy with their own equipment. That's one of the other facets of amateur radio, is we have our own equipment that we also will put that equipment as well as ourselves into service when called upon.
And your volunteers, what are they signing up for here? How long is the mission?
3 weeks.
3 weeks in Puerto Rico, and then they can re-up or they rotate back home?
I believe Red Cross has a kind of a policy. Once they come back, they've got to take a couple weeks off before they can deploy again.
Mike, you've got this amateur radio corps heading into a disaster zone. You guys have a slogan?
The one unique thing about amateur radio, and I think a bit of a saying that we use frequently, applies to the group that's going to Puerto Rico. The Marines are, of course, Semper Fidelis, always faithful. The Coast Guard is Semper Paratus, always ready. And amateur radio is Semper Gumby, always flexible.
Well, a small army of amateur radio operators in Puerto Rico, in partnership with the Red Cross, providing emergency communications all around Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. Mike Corey is Emergency Preparedness Manager with the National Association for Amateur Radio. Mike, thanks so much.
Thanks, Todd.
The Takeaway is supported by Indeed.com, where business owners and HR professionals can post job openings, review candidates, take notes, and schedule interviews from an online dashboard. Learn more at Indeed.com. By Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for businesses, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More details at Staples stores or staples.com/copy-and-print. Staples, it's pro time. And Fracture, creating modern photo decor by printing their customers' photo directly on glass. A Fracture is image, frame, and mount all in one, available in a selection of square and rectangle sizes. Learn more at fracture.me.
Hey folks, welcome back. Todd Zwillick with you. And we have a healthcare story now from Washington that's gotten a lot less attention than fights over the Affordable Care Act. The fiscal year ends tomorrow at midnight. And at that point, funding for the Children's Health Insurance Program, it's also called CHIP, is going to expire. Now, it's clear now that Congress is going to miss that deadline and that the spending authorization for CHIP will lapse. Now, we should be clear. It doesn't mean that money for the program is going to dry up right away. There's plenty of support from Republicans and Democrats for the CHIP program. It was created back in the 90s to provide health coverage to 9 million children from low-income families across the country. So lawmakers are promising that CHIP will be reauthorized. But let's face it, Congress is not functioning well these days. And there's plenty of anxiety in states that are more vulnerable to funding cuts that Congress might not get it right. Julie Rovner is Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News, and she joins me now. Julie, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Julie, let's start with the basics. What exactly does CHIP do, and who does it cover?
Well, CHIP was created in 1997, so it's 20 years old this year, to provide health insurance to children and families who make too much money to afford Medicaid, but basically too little money to afford private health insurance. It was supposed to be a gap filler, and it has become a gap filler. It now, as you mentioned, covers about 9 million children. The uninsured rate for children is in the very low single digits. I mean, it's been one of these huge bipartisan successes. It was bipartisan at the beginning. It was originally paid for with the tobacco tax. It is a very popular and quite successful program that's operating in all 50 states.
So if Congress, though, is going to allow this deadline to expire midnight on October 1st, like I mentioned, why doesn't that mean that funding dries up right away?
Well, states are given a lump sum and they're allowed to spend it over the fiscal year, and most of the states have money left over. But that doesn't mean that nothing will happen. There have been two different surveys. One of them found that three states would run out of money before the end of the year, but another one found out that 10 states could run out of money before the end of the year. And even if they don't run out of money, they have to do things when the authority technically lapses, like it's about to do, like start to wind down the programs, send families notices that their children are about to be cut off, freeze enrollment, change the enrollment mechanism. Remember, we're about to have the open enrollment for the Affordable Care Act, and there are people who, if they apply and turn out to be eligible for CHIP, would get put into CHIP. So it's not as kind of a benign delay as a lot of people are saying.
So it sounds like even if the funding from Congress doesn't dry up, on the ground with people with their coverage for their children could face a lot of confusion and anxiety. They get a notice in the mail by law saying your kid could be cut off, even if senators are saying that won't happen. That's scary.
It is scary. And, you know, states are going to have to spend a lot of money because technically, by law, they have to start winding down these programs, even though everybody assumes that the money is eventually going to be there. And I haven't heard anybody, even the most conservative Republicans, say that the money isn't eventually going to be there.
All right. So there's a lot of reassurance then coming from across the political spectrum in Congress. Pretty rare these days, Julie, given how dysfunctional things are. What's the promise from congressional leaders, House and Senate, or the leaders on this issue, that they're going to get this done? What are they saying?
Well, the Senate Finance Committee announced a couple of weeks ago that they'd come to a bipartisan deal on a CHIP bill. We haven't seen it. You know, they haven't passed it through the committee yet, so it hasn't gone to the floor yet. But we know that they've agreed to extend the program for 5 years, which was something that advocates wanted. There was a big chunk of extra money for CHIP in the Affordable Care Act. Everybody assumed that would be temporary, but they would phase it down rather than cut it off all at once. So, I mean, it's a real compromise here. Frankly, Republicans are in this situation because 2 years ago, the last time they reauthorized the program, Republicans insisted on only reauthorizing it for 2 years instead of the four that Democrats had wanted. And that's why we're right back here where we were.
Well, let's go back to that thing you mentioned about the Affordable Care Act, Julie Rovner, because you mentioned there was an expansion of CHIP inside the ACA. We've seen all of these fights over Obamacare and lawmakers, Republicans fighting to repeal it, committed to repeal. There's expanded coverage that covered a lot of kids in Obamacare. What happens to that expanded coverage now? Do some kids get cut off?
Well, they got about a 23% increase in the Affordable Care Act. It was interesting. There was quite a debate when the Affordable Care Act was being passed about whether CHIP would be continued at all. They were saying, well, you know, we're going to expand Medicaid and then we're going to have these subsidies for people to buy private insurance. Why do we even need the CHIP program? And I think at the last minute, they decided to keep it. And I think now a lot of people are glad, at least a lot of people who support the program are glad that they did, because in many states, CHIP is either an add-on to the Medicaid program or it's a freestanding children's program. And it is more functional, if you will, than many of the Affordable Care Act plans. But there was that extra money. It was always intended to be temporary. Of course, states now get used to having the money. So I think the hope was that it would phase down gradually. And that seems to be, at least in the Senate, what's happening. We're hearing that we're going to see text on Monday in the House. We don't know what they've come up with. We're not sure how bipartisan that is. I should mention that renewing CHIP, which has now happened, I think, 3 or 4 times since it was passed, has been contentious. Everybody agrees on continuing the program, but Democrats and Republicans don't always agree on what it should look like going forward.
All right. So it looks like Congress is going to get this done, as you say, Julie Rovner. You mentioned a minute or two ago they used to fund this with tobacco taxes. Hey, put a surcharge on cigarettes. That's great. You get money coming in, give it to children's health care. And if cigarettes are more expensive, maybe kids, everybody else will smoke less. Did it work? And are they going to do that this time?
Well, yes, it was sort of a win-win, but this time they're going to need to come up with other money for complicated budget reasons, or other money, too.
And have they decided how they're going to pay for it?
No, they have not. And that's obviously always the last thing that ends up hanging out when we're trying to, you know, do a big expensive program in Congress.
Congress has been debating the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. They've been debating taxes, tax cuts for corporations, and behind the scenes, a debate over health care for 9 million children from low-income families. Senators, lawmakers are promising that the CHIP program will be reauthorized, probably without a surcharge on cigarettes this time around, but nobody knows for sure. Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Julie, great having you.
Nice to be here.
USA, the chant echoed across Lambeau Field last night as the Green Bay Packers and Chicago Bears stood for the national anthem before their game in the NFL. Nobody on either team kneeled in protest. Members of both teams did stand with linked arms and called on fans to do the same. Protests in the NFL against police brutality did capture Americans' attention this week. And all week long, we've been getting different perspectives on speech and patriotism here in America. We have a view now from one American whose idea of patriotism and American exceptionalism radically changed once she left the country. Author and journalist Susie Hansen set up shop in Turkey when she started working as a foreign correspondent. She covered some of the strident nationalism that drives Turkish politics and then realized that what we call nationalism in Turkey wasn't so different from what Americans call patriotism in their everyday lives. She wrote about it in the book Notes on a Foreign Country and American Abroad in a Post-American World.
The problem is that a lot of that patriotism, a lot of that nationalism was founded at a time when, of course, parts of the population were not included in it. That the very myth that, you know, this is a uniquely free country, that it is a unique country, that it is the promised land was being formed at the time when, you know, thousands of people were still enslaved. But I think what's interesting about it is why do we tend to not see this as a form of nationalism, as a kind of a more pernicious force rather than an exclusive force, one that is, you know, might be defined according to some people as something that only maybe white people in the country own or certain groups own and certain groups do not, that it can also be used in an exclusive way and not an inclusive way.
What about the parts of American nationalism or patriotism that have served this country well? I mean, it's not one thing. And a lot of people, when they think about their pride in America or they think about their nationalism, say that it's not just a militaristic, sort of aggressively outward thing, but it keeps us bound together.
Well, I think that's true. And I think that's true for all countries. And so there is definitely truth to that. But I think that, and I think that you see now, you see a lot of people who are very heartbroken by what's going on in the U.S., the sort of, you know, the Trump voters versus liberals, this anger, this sort of violent rhetoric. And I think a lot of liberals for the first time are starting to question, you know, I'm hearing people say things like, well, I didn't realize how much I believed in American exceptionalism, how much I believed that we were special, that we were not, such things could not happen in our country. I think that there is this sense that we didn't understand what happened to us, what went wrong here. And that partially, you know, that is because we've been ignorant of not only, I think, a lot of our domestic history, but our foreign policy history, which I think is one of the biggest problems. We do not tend to think of ourselves as part of an empire, and we can wrestle with whether that word is accurate or not, but we have never reckoned with what those policies have meant for others. And I think to a large degree, we don't even know the details.
And I wonder how much of this about Americans, and I think a lot of what you're saying is true, I wonder how much of this is inevitable for some of us. I mean, we live in a country isolated by two oceans, a hegemonic power, number one economically, militarily strong, exercising our power in a form of empire. There's no question about it. When that's the dynamic, human nature is not to sit down and absorb the rest of the world. I mean, it makes a certain degree of sense.
It does make sense. It does make sense. But we have to consider ways that it's possible that the United States government after World War II and at the beginning of the Cold War actually designed our worldview so that we wouldn't consider them. The Cold War architects, a lot of the intellectuals at the time, were sort of saying, thing. We are the end of the evolutionary spectrum. We are the great modern nation. Everybody wants to be like us. We should go out and help them be like us. And we're not going to say that this is an empire. We're not going to call this colonialism. We're not going to go occupy them. We know that we can't do that because, you know, that's out of fashion. We're going to call it something else. And this was modernization, essentially. They kind of presented it, I think, as if this was just reality and as if there was a global consensus that everybody wanted to or aspired to be a sort of, you know, this liberal capitalist society like the United States. I believe we probably need a reconsideration of American history since 1945 in the same way that the Germans did. I think the Germans are the only ones who sort of reckoned with the failures of a former empire. I don't think the Brits have done it. I don't think the French have done it. But I think that the United States may want to have a national reckoning with this history, or they're going to continue to make the same mistakes that they have had. And I do think that this is, to a large degree, it's not the responsibility of the 50 million people living in poverty in America who've been suffering from these same policies as everybody else. It's the responsibility of the elites. And I am as critical of conservatives as I am of liberal elite institutions.
Well, here's a small reckoning on the domestic scene, not mm-hmm. the international scene. In the last couple of weeks, a football player called Colin Kaepernick and other football players kneeling during one of the most important pieces of symbology of nationalism and patriotism in this country, the national anthem, during an NFL football game. And that was a little piece of reckoning that a lot of people fought back against pretty quickly and pretty hard.
Yeah, and I think that was also, they fought back because they were encouraged to do that by the rhetoric of the president. You know, of course people are going to be afraid by gestures like that, but it is an opportunity to have a deeper and a better conversation. The people who do that, who are kneeling, I think are quite brave. The question is, why aren't the people who get so angry when they see that, why aren't they curious about their experience? Maybe something happened to these people that the angry nationalistic people don't understand. There is something going on right now that is the beginning of this confrontation. I think that we're just seeing the beginning of something that could be quite an ugly one. But I do believe at the same time, and I am very optimistic, that in a lot of ways we needed to have this confrontation before we can generate some new ideas about where we should be going with our self-conception, with our idea of American identity. And I do have some faith that we'll figure it out. I just think it might take a while.
America is wrestling with protest, patriotism, and nationalism. Susie Hansen is one journalist who's observed these American phenomena from outside the country. It's all part of her book, Notes on a Foreign Country and American Abroad in a Post-American World. Susie Hansen, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Have you ever seen a commie drink a glass of water?
What?
Why do you want a little bit? Because if you're going to drink, I'd rather you do it in the house.
Why do you think I'm calling you? Just to say hello?
Did you see the memo about this?
And you won't be angry?
I will not be angry.
This is healthy. This is good.
It's Friday when we talk movies here on The Takeaway. Man, when I hear Young Frankenstein in the montage, I just got to laugh. I love it. As always, Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, and The Takeaway is with us. Hi, Rafer.
Hello, Todd.
I'm giving you the day off from trivia. We got a lot of movies to get to, so you get a reprieve today.
All right, that's all right with you.
All right,
that's
no fun. Trivia today. But let's start with Judi Dench, because the new film Victoria and Abdul is out. We're going to listen to a clip. This is Queen Victoria striking up an unlikely friendship with a young Indian clerk named Abdul Karim. Listen.
I am a Muslim, Your Majesty. I learned the Quran from my father. He's my Munshi.
Munshi?
Yes, Munshi. My teacher.
Well, we would like you to be the Queen's Munshi.
But I'm only a servant, Your Majesty. A servant cannot be a Munshi.
Well, you are a servant no longer. You are my teacher. You will teach me Urdu and the Quran and anything else you can think of.
Rafer, the combination of period piece, costume drama, and Dame Judi Dench is lethal for your movie-going ticket money. This one's going to be big.
Of course. Also, Stephen Frears, who directed The Queen, is behind the camera. So this definitely has Oscar bait written all over it. What's also interesting is that, as unlikely as that clip sounds, this is a true story. There was a young man named Abdul who did become a confidant of the Queen and caused a great deal of uproar within her household. I think it's an interesting story. I think there's a lot of, it touches on a lot of issues of race and elitism and classism. The people in the Queen's household are very upset that she's hanging out with this Muslim and this dark-skinned fellow from India. I would have liked that message a little bit better if Abdul had been a more sympathetic character. He does indeed seem like he's kind of flattering his way toward the throne. Mm. That was kind of a problem for me. It sort of muddles the message a little bit. So even though I think Dame Judi Dench is terrific in the role, I was a little mixed on this one.
Well, that's Victoria and Abdul. Those period pieces are popular. I'm going to see that, I think. I got to see her perform as Victoria. It sounds pretty great to me.
She's Rafe, great as always.
Let's slam on the brakes from Queen Victoria, because Tom Cruise has landed work with the CIA.
What I'm about to tell you, you got to swear you can't ever tell anybody this. Lucy, I am working for the CIA.
So, you know, anytime you hear the words, I'm working for the CIA, you get a little suspicious, right? but this actually is at least partially a true story about a guy named Barry Seal, who was a TWA pilot who began running drugs for the Medellin cartel for Escobar. He gets sort of swept up into the Iran-Contra scandal briefly, becomes a DEA informant. Pretty wild life, incredible story. The CIA connection, a little less solid to me, a little less credible, but it's a great story, directed in a very jazzy, fun action style by Doug Liman, who did The Bourne Identity. Tom Cruise is great. I do think there's a little bit of they kind of try to make Barry Seal into the poster child for the Reagan-era hypocrisy and hubris and all this different stuff. I'm not sure if I really buy that, but I do think it's a lot of fun. And Tom Cruise, you know, I've said it before, I'll say it again, he's still a movie star and a lot of fun to watch.
He sure is. Tom Cruise is a quintessential American movie star, like it or not. Rafer, before we let you go, Robert Redford and Jane Fonda, they were together in Barefoot in the Park, in The Chase, other movies as well. They're back now in Our Souls at Night.
We're both alone. You know, we've been on our own for years. I'm lonely, and I'm guessing you might be too. It's about getting through the night, you know? Lying down in bed together and talking through the night until we fall asleep, that kind of thing. Would that be something of interest to you?
Well, I really wanted to like this movie. Who doesn't want to see Redford and Fonda back together again, even at this advanced age, which gives it a sort of an extra poignancy? It's a little too low-key, a little too dull for my taste, I have to say. I'm disappointed in this one.
Thanks, Rafer Guzman with Newsday.
Thank you, Todd.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for businesses, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More details at Staples stores or staples.com/copy-and-print. Staples, it's pro time.
Let's go across the street from Congress now to the Supreme Court, because on Thursday, justices agreed to hear a case that could be trouble for unions representing public sector employees. Now, some public workers pay dues to a union, even if they're not a member. But challengers, including conservatives and industry groups, they want to put a stop to that. The case is known as Janus v. American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And Janus is Mark Janus, a public sector worker who says the dues to a union he doesn't support violate his First Amendment rights. Adam Liptak is the Supreme Court reporter for our partner, The New York Times.
Well, the idea is that whether or not you're a member of the union, if the union is negotiating on your behalf, carrying out things that will make your life better, you should pay your fair share of those collective bargaining costs.
Meaning this sort of prevents free riding. If they negotiate a good contract and benefits and you benefit from that, you should contribute.
That's the theory behind it. On the other side of it is the notion that, you know, somebody negotiating with the government is taking positions on public policy on my behalf, and I have a First Amendment right to have a different point of view about retirement plans or benefits or even how much the government should be paying public workers. All of those are said to be issues of public concern and implicate First Amendment rights. So that's the clash.
And there is a blurry line here. I mean, the court has also said that workers don't have to pay for political activity that unions might engage in if they're not a member of that union, like some fee that would go to a super PAC or political advertising. The argument is that this might be a separate kind of union activity.
Yeah, so 40 years ago, in a precedent that has really held up, the court tried to draw a line between two kinds of things. It said, you have a First Amendment right not to pay for a union's political activities. So if the union is going to support a political candidate, it shouldn't take your money to support a candidate you might not want to support, that there's a First Amendment problem there. But it said there's some more routine activities of unions, like collective bargaining, that you should be made to pay for. And that 40-year-old precedent is the one that may well be overruled in this new case the court just agreed to hear.
Now, the court is usually so reluctant to overturn its own precedents. If that has been around for 40 years, Adam Liptak, why are they taking the case again?
The conservative side of the court has made it very clear that it's sympathetic to First Amendment arguments, that it's fairly hostile to unions. This very issue was argued before the court in January 2016, and it looked like it was going to go down 5-4 with the conservatives in the majority. But then a month later, Justice Antonin Scalia died, and the court deadlocked 4-4. But now we're back to a 9-member court with Justice Gorsuch replacing Justice Scalia. And most people think that Justice Gorsuch will, like Justice Scalia, take the anti-union position, resulting in a 5-4 decision against the unions.
And how much money are we talking about for public sector unions here? What's going to be the impact if the unions lose?
You know, I have to think it's many tens of millions of dollars. I think it's a very, very large sum of money.
And that's important to note. These are public sector unions, but Adam Liptak, we should contextualize this, I think, and mention that this is part of a decades-long strategy to weaken unions and their political activity across the country.
Yeah, I mean, this has been a long struggle between labor and management, with typically conservatives and Republicans on the one side supporting employers and liberals and Democrats on the other supporting workers. And the pendulum has gradually shifted. Union membership has fallen dramatically. And the one pocket of strength, really, for the organized labor movement is public sector unions, government unions. And if they can be weakened, that will be a big victory for conservative groups.
The Supreme Court has taken the case, and public sector unions are staring down the barrel of a possible defeat in their ability to fund their activities. Adam Liptak with the New York Times, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
We're staying right here until this guy is released.
Let the police car through if they release.
Welcome back, everyone. It's Todd Zwillick, and this Sunday is Free Speech Day in California. It marks the anniversary of the protest that started the free speech movement at the University of California, Berkeley in 1964. Mario Savio was a leader on that day.
We must really feel very, very sorry for these poor policemen here, you know. It's very like, you know, Adolf Eichmann. He had a job to do. He fit into the machinery.
Bravo!
Very good!
That's Mario Savio speaking to a crowd from the top of a police car on October 1st, 1964, protesting the arrest of a left-wing activist at Berkeley. Now, this week was supposed to be Free Speech Week at UC Berkeley, a completely separate and controversial four-day event full of far-right speakers, organized and bankrolled by activist and provocateur Milo Yiannopoulos.
What I try to do is be provocative and entertaining and blow open the fire doors, if you like, so other people feel a little bit more brave, a little bit emboldened to discuss their points of view in freer language than they would otherwise feel able to do.
The idea was to fight back against what conservatives feel is a stifling of their speech on liberal campuses in America. Milo planned to give a free speech award in Mario Savio's name, and that idea did not go over well with Mario's widow and fellow free speech activist, Lynn Hollander Savio.
Well, I was really appalled because Mario didn't stand for free speech. You can say anything you want anytime and not consider the consequences and the impact that your speech has on the people you're talking to. He believed that you had a responsibility when you speak.
In the end, that award never happened. Free Speech Week was canceled last week. The small student group behind the event said the school was putting up too many barriers for their speech, while the university said they were following the same protocol they do for all student events. Lynn Hollander Savio was a student in the crowd at UC Berkeley in 1964 when Mario Savio spoke. They weren't yet married, and she eventually became part of the free speech movement herself. Lynn says she supports Milo Yiannopoulos' right to free speech, but that she rejects his style, which she calls irresponsible.
I think that Milo, as long as he does not transgress the boundaries set by the courts, has a right to speak. And the university has a right to set the time, place, and manner of that speech. But Milo does something else, which I haven't heard because I've never seen him talk in person, but I understand that he attacks individual students by name, reveals their contact information, and invites harassment and attacks upon them. This is a really questionable use of free speech, and I have a great deal of trouble trying to resolve the contradictions between a free speech position and those kinds of attacks.
Well, the university was confronted with some dilemmas here, of course. UC Berkeley is one of the epicenters of champions of free speech, of course, but somebody like Milo comes to campus, and the leaders of the administration found themselves under pressure from students to, if not silence, to marginalize Milo Yiannopoulos and some of his cohorts.
Yes, I think the university was between a rock and a hard place. Whatever they did, they were going to get people angry. I applaud that they did set things up so that Milo could speak. Of course, the group that was sponsoring him failed to do any of the required things that are necessary to present a speaker. I've been presenting a speaker yearly at the university. We presented the Mario Savio Memorial Lecture and the Mario Savio Young Activist Award. And you always have to make deadlines and give deposits and negotiate with them about what space is available when and so forth. And the idea that you can just come in and say, we want to be here at such and such a date, and you know, we'll come back at that date and see you later. I mean, that's absurd.
Lynn, there's no doubt that Milo Yiannopoulos has First Amendment rights like everybody else, but people have sort of pointed out that his success, to the extent that he's had some in pop culture, is his role of the provocateur, his willingness to sort of throw back in the faces what a lot of people see as liberals' discomfort with ideas that they disagree with. And so that he's up there as sort of a satirist. Maybe he doesn't believe everything he says, but he's pointing up the weakness of liberals for hearing ideas that they don't like.
Well, I think you're using the term idea very loosely, because it's not Milo's ideas that are the problem. I disagree with them, but it's the name calling and the attacks on individuals that seem inappropriate in a college community where people have to relate to each other.
To take the argument of some of Milo's supporters right now for the sake of our discussion, I think they might say that his type of provocation wouldn't have any currency if things like safe spaces at colleges and places where people didn't want to hear speech or ideas they don't like weren't so common.
I think there's a real issue in that some people in the younger generation have not realized why free speech is so necessary, and so necessary for them, even if they are provoked. And unfortunately, they're young and they rise to the bait.
It sounds like you're fundamentally uncomfortable with the idea of the safe space on a college campus.
I agree. I'm not comfortable with the idea of safe space on a college campus. I think that it's important for students to experience themselves as able to take hurts. The African American students who marched in the South had to put up with tremendous abuse. And they did it, they were fearful. They had showed a great deal of courage, and we would not be as far along as we are today if they had said, you know, I can't participate in these marches because it hurts my feelings to be, you know, yelled at with the N-word and the other things that the people were yelling at them. So I think this idea of safe spaces is not a good one. But on the other hand, when you are on the campus, that is your home, and you are hoping that the other people whom you deal with will also consider it their home, and you're part of a family in a certain way. The point is individual responsibility, really. Milo should not be stopped by the state or by people shouting him down, but he should be stopped by his own individual sense of responsibility to act in a moral and ethical manner. And I don't feel he does.
And so if he doesn't have a sense of individual responsibility, where in your view does that place the limits on his speech? Or does it simply put the onus on the listener to walk away and leave him alone in the public square to talk to himself?
I would like to see students and other people develop a response which is both confrontational, but that allows him to speak, whether it's turning your back on him, whether it's walking out of his speeches, whether it's mooning him, or, you know, committing some other kind of mockery. We have to be more creative than just saying, you can't talk.
How important do you feel it is to allow people with awful ideas to expose themselves by presenting their awful ideas?
I think that is extremely important. I think it was better for the country to see the white supremacists rally in Charlottesville and to see what they're really like, rather than having them hide away and claim to have a virtue and a righteous position that they don't have. Better to turn the rocks over and let what crawls out crawl out. Also, better to let them have a feeling that at least their ideas are being heard and being rejected, and not delude themselves with the idea that, oh, if we could just communicate our beliefs, then everybody would be on our side.
Lynn Hollander Savio, I want to thank you for spending this time with me.
Thank you for having me.
Lynn Hollander Savio is a veteran of the free speech movement at University of California, Berkeley, and the widow of free speech leader Mario Savio. And here's a final outtake for you today. Tomorrow is International Podcast Day. Now, if you listen to our podcast here on The Takeaway, and I hope you do, you know that we start each episode with the day's date. And behind the scenes here at the show, that simple little thing can sound something like this.
Are you hearing me? 3, 2, 1. This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, November 30th, 2016.
This is the, and I say, this is The Takeaway podcast for Tuesday, December 6th. What is the date today?
Is it the 20th or the 21st?
Ready? This is The Takeaway for August 31st.
What day is it? Is it Tuesday? This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, September 26th.
I'm sorry, Cecil B. I need to know my lines again. So it's, this is The Takeaway podcast for September 27th, 2017. Can I give it to you from the top one more time?
All right. This is The Takeaway for Friday, July 21st, 2017.
Boom!
This is The Takeaway for September the 19th, 2017.
It's The Takeaway for Tuesday, April 11th, 2007. It's definitely 2017.
Okay, here we go. This is The Takeaway for March 17th.
Friday!
This is The Takeaway for Friday, September 29th, 2017.
Well, no matter what day it actually is, we hope you'll give our podcast a listen. Find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. See, guys, I tell you, talking down a microphone is hard. Have a great weekend. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Indeed.com, where business owners and HR professionals can post job openings, review candidates, take notes, and schedule interviews from an online dashboard. Learn more at Indeed.com. Want more information about the stories you hear on The Takeaway? Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors and opinions from your fellow listeners. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.